Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilo Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilo. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you could submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about myelodysplastic syndromes with Dr. Valeria Santini. Dr. Santini is associate professor of hematology at the University of Florence in Italy. Here's Dr. Stephen Gore.
Valeria, I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of background about how you became interested in hematology as a student or as a resident in Italy.
I really do like to answer your question because it's going back to my choices in life. And I've chosen to be a hematologist because I was fascinated by basic and translational research in the lab. And I was also very much interested in being a real doctor, in taking care of patients and treating them and curing them.
A real medical doctor. We have real PhD doctors in our audience who would take great umbrage at that.
Yes, it's true. But, you know, the short form for medical doctor, MD, is doctor. And in Italy, when you say doctor, even if we all are and we all have got a degree, is the physician.
Okay.
So,
dottore,
yes. So the physician was a sort of career that I would have liked because I really wished to take care of people. And at the same time, I wanted to find something that could couple laboratory research and care of patients. And then I met this very good teacher of mine. He is a professor of hematology, of course, now retired, and he gave excellent lectures mixing biology, clinical data, and ethical issues and moral issues. That was very, very interesting and challenging. So I moved to his department, and I start being I was already in the lab, working in the lab, and then I start being a hematologist, and I became real hematologist in 1988, so very long time ago.
I see. So, but as I understand it, medical training in Italy begins earlier than it would in the United States because you don't go to the equivalent of 4 years of college before medicine. Is that right?
Yeah, it's right. We have to make the choice of our life at 18. 19-year-old.
I couldn't have done that.
It was very hard for me. I wanted to be an art historian, being raised in Florence. I wanted to be a philosopher. I wanted to be many things. And then in the end, I've chosen what I thought was useful for mankind. And when you are a teenager, these are issues that are really strong and feelings are very strong in this sense. So I started as medical school, and medical school lasts 6 years for
okay.
us. And when you are finished, you have 1 year of practicing in the hospital. Then you have an exam, a national exam, and then you may practice medicine in general.
And now you're 25 years old or something at that time?
Yes, more or less. I ended up at 24. And then,
well, because you're very accelerated, of course.
Yeah, I wanted to finish early because then after that you have the postgraduate school, which takes you now 5 years more to become a hematologist.
I see. And is that a clinical training program or
it's
book training?
Both clinical, and you have to work in a hematology department, and then you have to have also theoretical training, quite a lot. So It's a beautiful period in which you are building up your specific interest in hematology.
Hmm.
And at the same time, you touch upon all the disease and subjects, and you see patients.
Hmm. But some of your training was done outside of Italy. Am I mistaken about that?
No, you're very right. When I started hematology, I was very interested in acute myeloid leukemia and acute leukemias. So I picked up the best place I could go in Europe in that period, which was Erasmus University. And in that years was Daniel Den Hoed Cancer Center in Rotterdam.
In the Netherlands.
In the Netherlands. And I was trained, and my mentor was Professor Löwenberg, and he kept me there for 3 years. And these were the most productive and very, very challenging years in my training.
It must have been so hard as an Italian speaker to be functioning in a science lab in Holland. I can't imagine you learned Dutch in Italy.
Of course not. And Holland was the only country I had never imagined to go in my life. I knew it for tulips and for nice people and kind people. So when I arrived there, it was a little bit of a cultural shock. Things were a little bit different then. Now they're more similar everywhere. But then people were very kind. And they all speak English, of course. They spoke an excellent English, so for me it was easier. And then little by little, I learned Dutch. To be more in touch with them.
Yeah. And you're probably a very small minority of Italians who also speak Dutch fluently, I'm guessing.
None that I know.
So after you were in the Netherlands, then you returned to Florence?
I came back to Florence, to my old department, and I started working there as a hematologist. And I got my position only in 94.
I see. So that's fascinating. So I know that you mentioned that while you were in the Netherlands, you were working on acute leukemia. Perhaps you could explain to our audience, because I think now your interest is more in chronic leukemias.
Yeah.
Could you explain to our audience, I think they think that an acute leukemia patient is probably much sicker. How do we differentiate between different kinds of leukemias?
When I see a patient with leukemia and I have to explain, and then I have to explain the prognosis, I always say, don't look at your neighbor who has leukemia and speaks to you, because every single individual is different. Leukemias are hundreds of kinds. You have the myeloid. Interesting is certain kind of cells in the bone marrow. Hmm. You have the lymphoids, which are more prone to give you enlargement on lymph nodes or spleen. And inside these two types, there are many other subtypes characterized by different genetic, molecular characteristics, by clinical characteristics. So it's very weird to speak about leukemias as a whole.
Mm.
You have to differentiate, and the prognosis is very different.
Mm.
So you can really tell it only patient by patient and not generally.
Got it.
And then I moved from AML and ALL, so the short form for acute leukemia, to myelodysplastic syndromes, which at that stage were thought to be a sort of pre-leukemic state.
What does that mean, pre-leukemia?
The possibility that a patient with myelodysplastic syndrome developed overt leukemia is not 100%. Mm-hmm. It's not always so high. But in some years ago, in the beginning of the studies of myelodysplastic syndromes, they were called pre-leukemia because they were seen as a state preparing to overt leukemia. So an increase in the number of immature cells. And then as a result, you had a very severe anemia, neutropenia, so prone to have infections and bleedings. So the disease was seen only as a prodrome to a more severe disease. Mm.
Well, how would I know if I had myelodysplastic syndrome? That sounds pretty scary.
It's a severe disease, even if it's not a leukemia. You have low counts, very low counts.
Blood counts, low blood counts.
Low blood counts, sorry. And you have it usually when you are in your mature age, I would say, when you are 60 or more. The mean age in Western countries is 70. So more or less, we say elderly, but now a 70-year-old is no longer an elderly.
Looks pretty
person.
Young to me.
Yes, exactly. They are very fit. So these people, just by chance or because they feel tired, they discover that they they have anemia, so low hemoglobin. They can bleed, and they discover that they have low platelets, and they can have recurrent infections, and they have low neutrophils, which are a kind of white blood cells defending us from bacterial infections and fungal infections. So all of a sudden, you realize that your blood doesn't work anymore as it used to. And your bone marrow, which is where your hematopoietic cells, so your blood cells are formed, is filled with progenitors trying to mature and not succeeding.
Hmm. So what happens to those cells that aren't turning into good blood cells?
They are dying in the bone marrow.
Oh, I see.
Mainly. So that's why you don't have anything in your peripheral blood, and you have an overcrowded bone marrow.
Wow. So that sounds pretty dangerous.
It is. Even if you are not transforming to leukemia, as I mentioned before, it's a disease that has to be taken seriously and has to be treated early to obtain nice results. Mm. We have the possibility to do so. And the most important thing I reckon is to be aware that this disease exists.
Mm. Well, it seems to me that perhaps awareness has become increased, at least in the United States, because this very famous television personality, Robin Roberts, has come out publicly. I'm not sure if you're familiar with, but she was on one of our news programs called The Today Show, and she turns out to have, I believe, myelodysplastic syndrome, which I think they said was caused by chemotherapy she had received for breast cancer. Does that happen?
Yes. That's a quite common problem that we have with solid tumor cancer survivors. Of course, we have many cancer survivors now, happily, but these people receive chemotherapy. And sometimes chemotherapy in specific individuals who are more sensitive to this may cause some modification of their cells, of their DNA, and then in the long run may lead to a myelodysplastic syndrome as a damage, a secondary damage of chemotherapy. It's not always like that. It may happen in some individuals, but sometimes myelodysplastic syndrome just arises as de novo
out
of the blue completely. And my patients, the first question I have from my patient is, why did I get this myelodysplastic syndrome? And unfortunately, in the majority of cases, I do not have an answer. You can say growing old, it doesn't really mean anything. You can say you have been exposed to dyes or to chemicals, whatever. But it's just guessing.
Of course, in Italy, most people are smokers, or at least many
people
are smokers.
They used to be. Now, since something like 10 years, we can't smoke in public restaurants.
Really?
And funny enough, people are really respecting the rules. Mm. So nobody's smoking. So I think this may have lowered the number of smokers. Not so much. Unfortunately, many young people are still smokers, heavy smokers.
And does smoking contribute to the formation of this disease?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But hopefully not coffee.
I hope not. Especially I hope not espresso.
All right, we're going to need to take a break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to Yale Cancer Center Answers to learn more about myelodysplastic syndrome and the practice of hematology in Italy with Valeria Santini.
It is estimated that over 200,000 men in the United States will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, with almost 3,000 of these diagnoses here in Connecticut. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, and at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Artemis machine is a new technology being used at Smilo that enables targeted biopsies to be performed, as opposed to removing multiple cores from the prostate for examination, which may not be necessary. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilo Cancer Hospital. Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my colleague Valeria Santini, who's an associate professor of hematology from the University of Florence in Italy. We're talking about her area of expertise, which is myelodysplastic syndrome, a kind of leukemia or a leukemia-related disorder. Valeria, before the break, we were talking about things which may cause myelodysplastic syndrome, or at least patients want to know about what's causing their myelodysplastic syndrome. Have things changed in this disease? You said you started practicing in, the 90s?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe about 20 years. So you're still very young in your field. But over these 20 years, has there been much change in the management of these patients or the diagnosis?
Major changes. And I'm very happy to say so. The diagnosis is much earlier and it's much more precise than it used to be. And the most important thing is that together with a better diagnosis, we have treatment. And we have active treatments, which didn't used to be available 10 years ago.
Mm.
So the patients who got the diagnosis of MDS, of myelodysplastic syndrome, were treated only with transfusion, so best supportive care, antibiotics for the events of I just indicated
as infections
and bleedings and so on and so forth. Now we have a lot of options we can offer to these patients for being treated, not cured, unless they can do, they can be eligible for a transplant.
A stem cell transplant.
A stem cell transplant, hematopoietic stem cell transplant, that is possible mainly for patients who are fit and not so elderly. But this is the curative approach still. But the treatment is possible, and improvements are really massive with the right treatment.
Hmm. Now, you had mentioned that for leukemias in general, there seem to be a lot of differences or heterogeneity between the patients. Is this true for this disease as well, myelodysplastic syndrome? Are there many kinds, or is it one size fits all, basically one kind of disease?
No, it's very very important to say that there are very many myelodysplastic syndromes. Syndrome means that it's a bunch of symptoms that look the same, mm-hmm. but doesn't mean that it's one disease. Mm. And we are now aware that there are more diseases called myelodysplastic syndromes, characterized by specific genetic lesion or specific features of immaturity in their hematopoietic cells, in the bone marrow cells.
Mm-hmm.
So you can call them with different names, but this is not only names. It's not only a matter of different definition. It's just a matter of different prognosis, different clinical characteristics, and therefore different outcome. So you have to pick up specific therapies for different subtypes. And it's very, very important that the patient pretend to be diagnosed precisely.
So it would seem that it would be important for patients with this disorder to really see somebody who has some special expertise in this group of diseases, as opposed to, at least for a second opinion, as opposed to a general oncologist or hematologist?
Surely. They have to have to be addressed to a specific, a person or a doctor who has a great experience in this disease, because it's very difficult to make a precise diagnosis, to have a good classification and to therefore to have a successful treatment.
And do you tailor the treatments based on the patient's underlying biological features or clinical features?
We can do something like that, not completely now, but we are on the way of being able to do it more and more. And I think in a few years we will be able to tailor it patient by patient on the basis of biology and, of course, on the basis of the individual health status of the patient. Now, we can do it now in at least in one myelodysplastic syndrome that is quite typical and is characterized by the deletion, meaning the loss of a part of chromosome 5. This specific myelodysplastic syndrome is an anemia that is observed mainly in women, but not only. And the fact that they carry this this chromosome abnormality, gives the patient a specific sensitivity to lenalidomide.
What's lenalidomide?
Lenalidomide is a difficult name to pronounce. It looks like a joke, but it's a very potent drug that just by serendipity was discovered to be very effective in DAL5Q in this kind, subtype of myelodysplastic syndrome.
Is it given like chemo in the clinic through the veins?
No, it's an oral drug, so it's a tablet.
You're kidding.
It's a tablet, but you should be aware that you can't give it as an aspirin or something like that.
No,
it's a drug that has to be handled by experts.
It's more expensive than aspirin. Also.
It's a little bit more expensive. Yes, it's extremely expensive. Still, we hope that in the future will be less so. And it's giving a very high percentage of success. It's a very good drug for this kind of patients who are no longer anemic when they take the drug.
Really?
Yeah, they get rid of the transfusions. They get rid of their symptoms of anemia. But when they take this drug, they have to take care that the other blood counts are not going down. Mm. They have to take care of adverse events, manageable, but you have to know which they are and treat them early. And so you can really go back to a very good quality of life. Mm. So this is the example of one new therapy that we are using for a specific biological featured MDS.
I know that you led an international study, or at least participated in an international study, that looked at the impact of this particular drug in MDS patients who didn't have that chromosome abnormality. Is that right?
Yes, it is, because usually anemic patients without this chromosomal abnormality respond very well to erythropoietic stimulating factors.
Erythropoietic stimulating factors. That's a very complicated set of words.
Yeah, but it's
easy. Is it English?
coming from Greek. But if you wish.
What does it mean?
These are hormones.
Okay.
These are hormones as insulin or other hormones. But the difference is that they stimulate red cells.
Okay.
So if you are anemic and you stimulate your red cells, then you are no longer anemic. And you can do this therapy. You can prescribe it for anemic patients. They do respond in a high percentage of cases, provided they are not DEL5Q. They do not have the chromosomal abnormality I just mentioned. These ones will respond for a short while, and then they need the drug we just talked about. And the patients who fail this stimulation with hormones, they are anemic, they need transfusions, and what we are looking for is some drug that can avoid transfusion. So we tried to study whether lenalidomide, which is so effective for the DAL5Q, is effective for the others.
And what did you find?
Well, we actually found a small proportion of patients, 26% around of patients, who do respond to this treatment, but we don't know why, and this is the most important thing, because you have to select this 25%, 26%, and on the basis of their characteristics, treat them immediately with the drug. But the rest is not responding, and therefore we are working hard to find other drugs that may unblock this situation and restore transfusion independence, so they don't need to go to the hospital, they don't need to sit there for hours and get their transfusion, although I must say that transfusion are saving lives, so you need them. You can't just say, I don't want to do it, and they're boring. Well, patients get really bored and tired. So you need a caregiver, you need to go to the hospital to spend time there, and these patients are elderly, usually, so they don't like it.
Will you be able to, do you have samples from these patients that you can study, from the patients from your study, that may be able to help you learn how to select the patients that will respond to this drug? Is that part of the project?
Yes, yes. We are very busy trying to find a clue of why they do respond in terms of studying their mutations, so meaning problems in DNA, or in their genetic asset, and then just try to see whether other clinical clues are helping us. Mm. But we are still in deep water, I'm afraid.
As is often the case. Now, you had mentioned, or several times you've mentioned, genetic abnormalities in the patient's cells. And do you mean to say, and I don't think you do, are these diseases that people are inheriting genetically that they, from their parents?
No, that's a good point to stress. And that's a question I always constantly have from the grandparents, from my patients who are grandparents, and they're very worried that they can
pass it on.
It's not a disease that you pass on. It's not, there is no, absolutely no danger in this sense. The problems you get, the genetic problems and the genetic abnormalities are acquired during life, and they do not affect the progeny. Mm. So the grandchildren are safe.
Good. Yeah, no, I think that's a common, we have a lot of people on our show talking about genetic abnormalities, and I think it causes a lot of anxiety.
Yes,
but
I understand.
The medically, we use the term genetic to mean abnormalities in DNA, whether we inherit them or they're acquired. So thanks for helping clarify that.
Yeah.
Valeria, I know that you've spent some time at some U.S. hospitals. I know you spent some months at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston.
Yes, I did.
And you've visited many places. How do you think things compare in hematology in the system in Italy compared to what you've seen? I realize you're not an expert in how things are in the United States, but what are some similarities or differences?
Well, when I was in the States, I was visiting and I was not able to take care of patients in a first hand. So I just observed. And MD Anderson is a specific reality. It's very different from everywhere else,
sure.
I think. They have a lot of new drugs, experimental drugs, and the main vocation of the center is to give new therapies for any disease. So they have a complete different approach from the routine we have. And that's one point. So what is very different from Europe is the fact that in Europe we are organized in a way that you are treating your patients without so much support of physician assistant, nurses. There are very few research nurses, for instance, and nurses have a marginal role in the management of patients.
Mm.
We are trying to change it to improve the care of the patients, but still it is organized in a different way.
Hmm.
So in the States you have more outpatients that are taken care of than we can do, because what we are trying presently to do, both in France and in Italy, is to have a treatment care for patients with MDS on the territory. So we are trying to organize a system in which the nurse during treatment can go and see the patients at home.
Oh, nice.
Which is, by the way, very difficult because of the expenses.
And, yes, of course.
And the crisis and the budgets are limiting us in this moment.
Hmm.
And then the difference among the states and between the states and Europe, let's say generally, is the fact that in Europe, overall, we have a national health system that is taking care of all the patients, so they all come to you. Whereas very rarely you are treated privately, especially not if you are an MDS patient.
Hmm. And patients don't have to pay for their care,
absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely, nothing.
Well, that's a huge difference. And I would wish we had more time to talk about that. I realize you're not a health economist, but it's certainly a difference I've seen in terms of the financial burden to the patients.
Yeah, we have limitations only in terms of general budget, but not individually. All the patients are treated with the best drugs we can get, and they don't have to pay.
Dr. Valeria Santini is Associate Professor of Hematology at the University of Florence in Italy. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, and we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudet, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.